Okay. I think that the idea of quasi-emotion is immediately appealing because many people will have an association with fiction, that it is that fiction, narratives, films, etc., are experienced in the first place as artifacts and cannot produce real emotions. So quasi-emotion seems intuitively attractive and plausible as a notion. But I think in order to see what we mean by it, we need to have some definition of what emotion is. And then we can see whether quasi-emotion is a deviation from emotion concepts, and in what ways. So let me first explain to you what my model of emotion is, and I think it's a fairly accepted standard model of emotion. As an example, we will take fear of forest fire. I am in Australia on a road, and suddenly I'm closed in by a forest fire that comes to me. And to understand the emotion that I have there, namely fear, we can agree that emotions are for something, in the service of something. And in the functional conception of emotion, emotion systems are for realizing people's or organisms' concerns. We will come back later to what is meant by concerns, but let's assume that people have needs that need to be fulfilled, and so concerns are sort of basic needs. In the case of the forest fire, the concern is to maintain my life and bodily integrity. So it's a concern for safety that is addressed by the stimulus situation. And emotions link concerns with action. Emotions are for something. They control people's actions in order to have them to have better opportunities in life. So when I see the fire, I immediately appraise the fire as threatening, dangerous, and coming close. And I have an embodied action readiness, namely to get out of this place and to flee. So understanding that this is a dangerous situation prepares me to act, to flee. And that's how emotions realize my concerns. They make it urgent, and they press upon me a desire or a need or an impulse to act this way or another. This could all happen in the dark, so to speak. The system could do its work without any conscious awareness of it. But in the definition of emotion, as I will use it, feeling is a necessary component of emotion. The experience of the situation as I appraise it, and my embodied reactions, and my readiness for action, all together are experienced as a conscious emotion. And the core of that feeling, of that experience, is the most raw appraisal and action readiness, namely affect. So even before I have categorized the threat as it's a forest fire and it's coming close and it works this way or that way, and I can do this or that, there's an immediate gut feeling, this is not good for me, I have to go away. So that is what we call affect. And I would say if one of these three components is missing, then I would say it's not a genuine emotion, but an emotion-like state. It's not my intention to say that this is the definition of emotion, but it will be my working definition in order to understand what we could mean by quasi-emotions. Can fiction produce genuine emotion? has been addressed by Greg Curry yesterday, and he said there were philosophers who gave answers to this question. Some of them said, my emotional reactions to a slimy monster that I see in a movie is an anomaly. It's not even worth the while to explain. Redford, for instance, and Rorty and Greg Curry explained what they really meant. But, of course, we recognize when we have emotions if feeling, emotional experience, is a defining characteristic of emotion. Then we have to take the reports of people who read a novel or view a movie, we have to take these reports serious. Because if the feeling, the experienced feeling, is a definitory feature of emotion and people report that feeling, then there's all reason to say, so they have an emotion. Reports, self-reports of emotion are ubiquitous. Go with your friends to a cinema or watch what people say after having seen a movie. Watch their reactions on the internet. Watch what critics and reviewers tell. It's all about feelings they have. So I think people have real emotions when they are confronted with fiction. I think that the most interesting treatment of the phenomenon of emotions in response to fiction is by Walton, and his work has been already referred to many times in the past day, so I can be brief. I think that he is the philosopher who used the word quasi-emotion, at least for the first time. And his argument is fiction is make-believe, and it's imagination, a product of the imagination, and an imagination stimulus, for instance. We see a slimy monster in the movies, and then we have a belief of reality necessary for a genuine emotion. You need a belief of reality in order to have a genuine emotion. But fiction produces fictional beliefs, so we cannot have genuine emotions. And he says quasi-emotion is not a real emotion, but it's a sensation, between quotes. It's based on the make-believe of being afraid. We are not afraid, but we know we believe that we are afraid. So he says, but the emotional response can come very close to genuine emotion. If Charles watches the slimy monster on the screen, he gasps and he grips his chair. But possibly, Walton says, not the entire physiological response spectrum is present, but he didn't know about the research done in your great project. They are there. Quasi-emotion is not genuine emotion, and especially in Walton's conception, what I call feeling is sensation. It's quasi-feeling. Now, emotions are elicited by events that are not objectively real, but they are appraised as real. And the intensity of feeling corresponds to the reality appraisal. This is a basic law of emotion and reality from Nico Freida's work. And I'm going to expand on Nico's work on the subject. Freida says, the most effective stimuli are perhaps unconditioned releases of action readiness. If you see a snake, you run. And it's real because we are built to respond to the snake by fleeing. That's in our system. So that's perhaps the most typical example of reality, perceived reality. And lots of effects, in movies at least, work because they are unconditioned releases. If we have at least the suggestion of a snake which has certain movements, then it's a sufficient releaser of an unconditioned fear response. So in that case, even a fictional snake can provoke genuine fear because of its sensory likeness ingrained in our perceptual and emotion system. But Freda says, notice that vivid imagination too has properties of reality. It's capable of eliciting or abating strong emotions. Imagination conceivably serves to transform symbolic knowledge into emotionally effective stimulation. And he continues, it also applies to the tear-jerking demonstration that love or acceptance or a happy ending after said suffering do exist as possibilities when they are put before us in sentimental films. And here Freida proposes that a possibility, appraising a possibility in a situation, fictional or real, can be sufficient to launch an emotion. So reality includes appraising possibilities. A glimpse of the unexpected, especially, or even never thought of possibilities, are strong reality triggers of aesthetic emotions. Note that there's a similarity to Walton's quasi-emotions, but the aesthetic emotion that is the response to this appraisal is a genuine emotion. It's not a quasi one. So possibilities, appraisal of possibilities, can produce emotions. The example is the character in a romance movie that loses her beloved. And Freida says, it's a perfect realization of an idea, even if it's fictional. That form is real. That form is recognized as real. It's an object in the real world, the form. So the source of responding emotions may be that such perfection actually exists or actually is a possibility. Now, this explanation by Nico Freida points in a certain direction. And he's aware that the real work needs to be done yet. The effects of imaginal stimuli underline the major problem behind the law of apparent reality to explain why one kind of cognition is not equivalent to another, but can have the same result. In this presentation, I will try to elaborate on this idea of Nico Freida. He passed away several months ago, and I would like to present to you a sketch of how emotionally effective cognition is triggered by fiction. I consider fictional narratives as simulations, and I draw the idea from Keith Oatley, who proposed that fictional narrative runs simulations on the mind, just like computer programs run simulations on computers. Now, in order to be effective for the production or generation of genuine emotions, the simulation has to be compelling. And Oatley mentions two features of simulations that are effective, namely use of schematic inference. So a good simulation does not present a one-to-one detailed reality, but it leaves some work to the viewer. Viewers have to make inferences from knowledge schemas. And another way in which simulations can be effective is by suggestion, not by really showing or presenting a snake, but suggesting the snake. Here again, the idea is that the viewer has to do some work in order to get at the emotional appraisal. Now I consider the idea like Nico Freida does, that aesthetic form is also a feature of an effective simulation. I think that one characteristic of fiction is that it has form. Probably everyone thinks of fiction as imaginary, impossible, not real. But we should not forget that the fiction that we deal with in our world has a form. Not every thing that I conjure up is fiction. So the culturally conventional ways of fiction, novels, stories, pictures, etc., have an aesthetic form. And I think that it is this aesthetic form that, in order to be grasped, requires another kind of cognition than we use in assessing reality in the real world. So form is perhaps the answer on one kind of cognition that is not equivalent to the other. I could show you an example of how it works. And how am I doing with time, John? I have used up so far. Okay, 30 minutes, fine. Well, I wanted to show you a sequence from Vertigo, Hitchcock's Vertigo. But I have static pictures, and perhaps they will tell the story a bit faster. So form is an abstract system underlying aesthetic artifacts. Form is appreciated at another level of reality assessment than represented objects, events, persons, etc. So we have, on the one hand, a story world where we see objects, events, persons, etc. faked on the screen. And it's all connected by a certain form. Form is a gestalt, or gestalt-like. It's perceived at once and complete. It's not necessarily grasped, for instance, at the beginning of a story, but while a story or a narrative unfolds, the gestalt is perceived at some point, and then it's perceived in its completeness. So this is important for the kind of cognition we are talking about. Form can be analyzed as to what makes it good. Analyses of cultural products of fiction reveal formal systems. Figurative art and narrative have been analyzed by critics, and there are good analyses and approaches to analyses that are sufficient to see what the system in a form is. Narrative form has thematic elements, story and style elements, in some organic harmony. They develop and they make points about a represented world. And this is the way that fictional narrative opens up reality of possibilities. As the narrative unfolds as a form, and the form includes points about some reality, and because that form, that gestalt, is developed and becomes a reality, it sort of carries over a reality to the possibilities implied in the form. The example, there are spoilers in it, but can't do without. Vertigo, Sueur, Le Sueur Froid, a movie by Hitchcock. The story is San Francisco, late 1950s. Scott Ferguson has left the police service after he lost a colleague while they were chasing a criminal across the city's roofs. The colleague fell to his death due to Scott's failure to reach his hand. Scotty has a trauma and suffers from vertigo. Now Scotty is a private detective. He is asked by millionaire Gavin Elster to tail his wife, Mrs. Elster, Madeline. Private Eye Scotty meets then Madeline for the first time in Ernie's restaurant, and he is immediately mesmerized by her. He follows her and he becomes fascinated by her weird ways. Madeline seems to be possessed by her great-grandmother, who lived an unhappy life 100 years ago. When following her, Scotty rescues her from a suicide attempt. They fall in love after telling about her other life. As Carlotta Valdes, her great-grandmother, Madeline jumps from a bell tower. Scotty cannot rescue her due to a vertigo again. Depressed, he's taken into a psychiatric hospital. So this all sounds quite implausible, I think. When released, Scotty is haunted by memories of Madeline and feverishly looks for her. Weeks later, he has a chance meeting with a lookalike of sorts. She is Judy Barton. They begin an affair, and Judy starts to love the man who is looking for another woman. Scotty obsessively dresses and makes up Judy to look like Madeline as he saw her the last time. Judy is unhappy with her role. In the end, the makeover does look perfect. Scotty discovers that Judy impersonated Madeline and was part of a plot to cover up the killing of the real Mrs. Elster, whose body was thrown from the tower, while Judy, the fake Madeline, escaped with Elster. He convinces Judy, or rather forces her, to accompany him to the bell tower in order to make up for his failed rescue of Madeline. On top of the tower, Scotty has overcome his vertigo. He accuses Judy that she lured him into acting as the witness of Madeline's staged suicide. Judy complies and they make up. Their kiss is interrupted by a nun appearing at the top of the stairs. Judy screams and falls to her death. The formal system. There are a thousand ways to unmask formal systems, but I'll give it a sort of freshman try. Formal systems can be described as coherent elements. For instance, David Bordwell has done that for film, starting from Russian formalism. And the principles of form are unity, similarity, difference, repetition, variation, function, and development. These are relations between the elements of the form. What do we have in Vertigo? We have, for instance, metamorphosis as an important theme. Madeline becomes Judy, becomes so-called Madeline. And there's a play with similarity and differences of the looks of Madeline and Judy. There's repetition and variation there. There's the motive of the vertigo spiral, and there's parallelism in the same way that Judy leads Scotty to the bell tower in order to stage the suicide. Scotty leads her again to the bell tower in order to overcome his vertigo and to make things right. The stylistic coherence and function of style for a narration support the plot development. Loss of loved, search obsession, regain of loved, discovery of betrayal, and the definitive loss. The form of this movie is cinematic tragedy. Theme is fatal male obsession. The point that the form of cinematic tragedy makes is what happens to man who makes his projection reality. Dieu créa la femme. That is tragedy. What happens to you then? And this perfect form of vertigo as a cinematic tragedy is recognized, and this recognition of the form as actual or real opens up the possibility implied in this form. Cinematic tragedies, in cinematic tragedies, this happens. And because this form is seen as so real, we can extend it as a possibility to real life. So an emotional response to subscribing to the reality of a possibility is awe. After you have seen this movie, or while you are seeing the movie, you are impressed by the tragedy form, and your response is, oh, this can happen. There are, of course, other real emotions that come up because the possibility is recognized as real. Compassion with Scotty, understanding his tragic fate, resignation perhaps in the end. And I would claim that these are genuine emotions because there are concerns at stake. In the case of tragedy, there's an appeal to our sympathy concern. Concerns or self-relevance is not only the prospect of gains or losses to yourself, but people also have altruistic or social concerns because they are social species, and that's why we can have sympathy with other people, but also with protagonists when we see the form that contextualizes their behavior as real. We have action tendencies. So perhaps I could do a survey asking people, I would stop the film and ask, would you like Scotty to overcome his vertigo? I did surveys like this, and people, without any hesitation, say yes. So people, in response to fiction, can have virtual action tendencies. They have the action tendencies that witnesses have. You see an accident happening at the other on the other side of the street, and you say, oh gosh, I wish this would not have happened. So there you are unable to act. Same goes for the cinema viewer, unable to act. You have virtual action readiness, but action readiness it is, and objective feeling. Very fast to illustrate how form can be realized and be recognized as real. The narrative part of the form of the cinematic tragedy is a loss. Namely, in the prologue, Scotty has lost his innocence because he has failed to rescue the other detective. Then there's a second loss, namely the loss of his love, Madeline. And it implies failure, guilt, and obsession on the part of Scotty. Then in the story, there's a regain of Madeline, but we have to say Madeline question mark. And it implies a makeover. And it also implies a loss. So this is a sort of mixed blessing figure in the form. Madeline is lost because, in fact, she's unmasked, and she appears to be Judy. Judy is implied in this loss. And Judy is the result of the makeover, spotting Judy. And because Judy stands for the Elster plot, she implies betrayal and anger on the part of Scotty. But Judy also loves him, and in the final loss, he not only loses a parent, Madeline, but also the only one that loves him, and that is Judy. And in the end, there's failure and guilt, and in cinematic tragedy, the implication is like the Greek tragedy hero's fate. Failure and guilt is the end of your psychological existence. So this is really the end of the person, Scotty. Okay. So this is the form of cinematic tragedy, and it has it overlaps with tragedy in general, where a human hero falls victim to powers and to his own fatal limitations, ignorance, blindness, hubris. This goes for Vertigo as well. And there are specific cinematic tragedy points. Male hero falls victim to a woman, which is like the film noir, same period. There is an uncanny element in this tragedy, which is specifically filmic. There is a projection of a love ideal into an image, which fits very well visual medium like cinema, so that it's another specification of tragedy for cinema. He tries to create a woman and he's destroyed, like in the film. So the cinematic tragedy is in fact a hybrid, but recognized as such. Now we see how these important elements of the narrative form are supported by style, by film style. For instance, The Loss of Madeline is introduced formally because she is so emphatically introduced when Scotty meets her the first time. And I think that a good formal analysis would show that this image of her profile walking into the direction of the restaurant exit, but not watching Scotty, so in profile, is a sort of anchoring stylistic choice. She walks through the restaurant and then she stops under a spot, so there's emphatical top lighting. There's this profile view, and that already gives a sense of that she is that she cannot be reached by Scotty. In her disappearance, which is the end of the loss episode, we don't see her face at all. We only see the body on the roof. So there is a sort of opposition, facial shot and not the face. And then the regain of Madeline, there we see again a profile view. This is the first view that Scotty has of Judy, and he thinks he recognizes her. Then he goes to her hotel room and we see her en face, and she watches him, which is new because that didn't happen in the restaurant. Here we have her face more in close-up, and here is a shot that really matches the introduction of Madeline, but here the profile is looking left instead of right, and it's not lighted, so there's a very conspicuous contrast between this shot, this framing, and this lighting with the introduction of Madeline. And here Scotty has the idea, yes, I have found Madeline again. Then there's the remake, and it ends up with a close-up where she is, where the face is exactly as in the introduction, but now she watches Scotty, so we see her en face, and that's also a sort of opposition to that introduction shot. By the way, for a comparison, there are other shots of the face of Judy Madeline, not profile and not en face, and that's when she is protesting against being modeled like Madeline by Scotty. So here she is the victim of Scotty, and we see her from the back, shot from the back, and looking left, and shot from low, below. Then Judy's death. I think this is the only view we have of Judy just before she falls from the tower, and then we never see her again, like Scotty. And this is also the last view Scotty has of her. And here, perhaps, the opposition with the introduction is quite apparent. Every aspect of the framing of the face is different from this one. So this is a sort of underlining of the loss by the formal system. So the recognition of form is conducive to making implausible events overruled by form and by the points. And then we tempt to accept points made by the narrative, we tempt to comply, and we subscribe to the possibility in the real world. So this can happen to someone who tries to model a woman according to his ideal, and we feel awe, genuine awe. I will skip this. So this is how fictional simulation can lead to genuine emotion. And I think that fiction should not be defined as producing quasi-emotion. So fiction is not tied to quasi-emotion. But without compliance on the part of the viewer, there's no acceptance of possibilities as real, and there's no genuine emotion. So there, in order to have genuine emotion, the simulation needs to be compelling, and I would argue form plays a role in it. This does not exclude that fiction produces something like quasi-emotion, emotion-related states that bear some similarity with genuine emotion. And let me give you a proposal. The idea of quasi-emotion is based on extending the model of simulation to collaboration or co-construction. An author supervises the imagination by the spectator, and the recipient engages in the simulation. Then there's a co-construction where the respondent, as an outcome, subscribes to the reality of the possibility. Here's a quick overview of the distribution of roles in this collaborative simulation. The author needs to do acts to persuade the recipient, and the recipient complies. The author, the part, is in joint attention and in joint imagination. Joint attention by signaling things, cueing things, like the example of the faces. And the recipient focuses attention and inferences, imagines in response to suggestion. And as an outcome, the author has the fictional narrative as a whole, the intended form, and intended reality appraisals and intended emotions, while the recipient contributions are in the outcomes, the perception of the form, the appraisal of the reality of possibilities, and genuine emotion. So this is the idea of collaboration in fiction. We can also summarize these roles by saying the author delivers an emotion design, and the recipient's contribution is following the design and then having genuine emotion. Now, if the recipient is aware of the simulation, he can have an understanding of the emotion design. So the recipient, who remains aware that it's fiction, so aware of the simulation, can follow the acts of the author, the persuasion acts. For instance, I can see the lighting here is different from the first scene. Aha, this is intended to give me this or that idea of reality or feeling. The simulation unaware recipient does not follow the emotion design and stays in his or her own column, so to speak. And I think that the simulation-aware recipient, attending to the author's acts of persuasion, results in understanding the author's emotion design as a cold cognition. I just have grasped the plan of the author in laying out the form, and I can appreciate that. Form is grasped as constructed, but not perceived. So it does not allow for emotional appraisal of reality of possibility. And then the recipient's emotional response is grasped, possibly including simulation of how it would feel, what it's like to have the emotion. I can see what the author intends to do with me. I can see now I must have awe, it seems. And I can even simulate how it feels to have awe in response to some scene. So this is what could be a quasi-emotion. It's Walton's sensation. We have a feeling, but it's between quotes. We know what it is like to have that feeling instead of having it. And that's because we have focused on the construction by the author instead of taking the cues, following the cues, and having the genuine emotion. Now, we can also appreciate the emotion design. While not feeling awe for Scotty's fate, we can still see this is a very well-made movie. There's a good form in it. I like the gestalt and how it has been made. So we praise the author's persuasion acts, his formal considerations, choices, and the reflections of fiction and reality that it unleashes, and we can even appreciate the intended emotion. Yes, that's a good way to make people feel awe for the possibility of killing your darling. And that results in a genuine emotion, but it has the artifact and the author as an object instead of the possibilities in the story world or the real world. So the quasi-emotion is, as it were, appraised as that's a good emotion and it has been well constructed. So that this is not the quasi-emotion itself, I would say. This is the quasi-emotion, grasping it, understanding it, and then you don't have an emotion but a cold cognition. And it can be followed or not by admiration or appreciation of the author's work. To end up with open questions, just a few, can we have emotions and quasi-emotions at the same time, or are they mutually exclusive? If I follow how the form is constructed, does that render my real feeling impossible? Perhaps we can shift between one and the other. Many of you will have the experience that you can watch a movie and be moved, but from time to time, the construction of the film becomes transparent and you suddenly see, aha, this is why I am so frightened. And then it seems that you shift between the two modes, if you will, of simulation. Can you do that at will? It's another question. And for answers to such questions, we need to know more about cognition of form and how perceived perfection of form carries over into emotional appraisal of fictional possibilities as real. So, Nico's final remark, Nico Freider's final remark, that the major problem behind the law of apparent reality, namely what sort of cognition is it, has not been solved yet. I think there is a lack of studies of how we perceive form in fiction. And that's perhaps a nice sentence to end with in time.